tracking individual particles that are inside these fungal networks and trying to understand how they're using these flows to move the resources in a way that not only allow them to extract the resources and trade it with the root, but get a fair price in the sense that they are essentially calculating across the entire network where to move the resources.
And they're vast. Individual mycorrhizal fungi form vast networks and extend over huge areas, and they are individual, single individual organisms.
Yes, so they are individual organisms which potentially can cover, maybe even square kilometers in forest. We actually do not know. But so the idea is that, they make these networks, they grow, these individual fungi, but it's always like it's a community, it's with many different species, and they simultaneously link different plants. So they create really like physical links between plants below ground. And they really, they trade these sugars for these nutrients in the soil. And there was some very interesting research by Toby Kears that really the fungi can really choose which plant they give more nutrients, and that they, of course, they give more nutrients to the plant from which they get more sugars. And the other way around is also true, that the tree is able to give more sugars to the fungi that give them more nutrients. So it's really like a trade interaction.
My name is Toby Kears. I'm a professor of evolutionary biology at the Free University in Amsterdam. The fungi are actually very good at taking resources from where they're very readily available and then moving them across the network to places where they're less available and the plant is willing to pay more for them. So where resources are low, they are getting more carbon in return from the plant. And you can imagine, I mean, these fungi have been under natural selection for hundreds of millions of years. It's not surprising that they would have evolved strategies that allow them to optimize their trading patterns. It's really a bit about a poker game, right? So this is what we're trying to understand, is this trade for carbon to phosphorus, and you've got the plant root on one side and the fungal network on the other, and they've been doing this for 450 million, I get shivers thinking, 450 million years. And so this is me in the corner, just trying to watch. And I would argue that a lot of what's been happening is in the dark, right? In these systems, it's totally underground. So it's very, very hard to understand and track these trade strategies.
So I'm opening up a video right now of some of the dynamics that we're seeing inside these networks. What surprised people the most is that this is in real time, right? These are videos that are not sped up. This is actually what's happening below our feet. And so it's a very, very fast, dynamic movement. It looks like a living river, but how can a river have so many different dynamics at once, where you can have the river banks flowing in two different directions simultaneously? Nutrient rivers that are just pulsating with carbon and phosphorus and nitrogen, and they're connecting plant roots. These are ecosystem engineers. I think most people would agree now that if we lost the fungi, the soil would not stick together. It would just start washing away. Fungi are the seam that hold ecosystems together. And yet we don't know who is where. And so we've started this project as the first attempt to get a global picture of where these fungi are. In the next 18 months, we're trying to gather about 10,000 samples. And so it's a massive effort to put these fungi on the map, the way that we have maps of global vegetation or ocean currents, right? These are all systems that we have started to map. Even the stars, we have better maps of than global fungi underground. And this is just key. It's just shocking to me that we haven't developed these maps, considering how important they are for our climate, how important they are for plants and therefore for animals, all surviving above ground, and yet to have no idea of how these networks connect ecosystems across the Earth is shocking to me. There's a really growing, a large and growing body of research that's showing just how negative deforestation can be for fungal networks. And sometimes it takes decades for these networks to recover. Fire systems, you know, there's some fungi that are amazing that are able to come right back after a fire system. But these symbiotic mycorrhizal networks are not one of those types of fungi, and they take a very long time to come back. And again, you know, decades can go by, and then still low levels of diversity, low levels of abundance. Agricultural systems, especially conventional agricultural systems, where, you know, there's tillage, there's pesticides, there's fungicides. You know, eventually there's just not much soil life left. I think the latest UN numbers say that 90% of soils will be degraded by 2050, right? 2050, I can picture 2050. That's very soon. And so that's what we have to worry about. Don't leave your soil bare, right? That's a really, really, really bad thing for fungal networks. You know, advocate for green roofs in cities. A lot of people don't know, but these fungal networks, they spread through spores airily. They're in the air, the spores, right? And so if they can have some kind of corridor of green through cities, this helps them survive. This helps them form healthy networks within the urban environment themselves, is having green spaces. So people can talk about underground ecosystems the way that they talk about Amazon forests and coral reefs, right? They can start to appreciate the organisms that live down there. And I think to be able to do that, they need to understand, they need to start being able to visualize what is under our feet. So we founded Spun to start to map, protect, and harness these fungal networks. What we want to do is get citizens and the public and activists involved in this process. People that, you know, are interested in fungal biodiversity and are interested in going out and sampling in their own yards and helping us build a bigger, clearer global picture of these fungal networks. In the next 18 months, we hope to collect about 10,000 samples. We want to develop the first red list, right, for fungi. You know, which ones are we most worried about? And maybe not within the first 18 months, but a big goal of ours is to develop the first fungal conservation easement, right? So that we could have land conserved for something other than plants or animals or the things that you see above ground, but a conservation priority for something you see, you don't see below ground. And I think this is kind of a moment, right? Where we have this chance to overturn our above ground bias. Right? I mean, for decades, we've been focused, centuries, everything is about above ground climate solutions, above ground conservation strategies. All the agendas are about what we see above ground, but they fail to recognize what's happening below ground.
Yeah, this initiative that Toby started, right? The Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. I mean, yeah, we really need to map these networks globally. We really need to try to understand, what these networks look like and how they function ultimately.
Yeah, it's really exploration, you know. And it's essential. Without these fungi, the trees wouldn't be able to grow. And many of our terrestrial ecosystems would simply not exist the way we know them, so. The real challenge here is actually to get to the roots. So you have to break through the pavement. This guy from the city that's going to help us has brought some tools. And they're now lifting some of these stones from the pavement. And it's intriguing, like there are people walking here and cars parked, but we are really walking over a living network of tree roots and fungi. There's like so much happening below our feet, even here in the city, you know, that is remarkable, I think.
Underground networks.
Yes, underground networks, yeah.
Special thanks to Bart Brown and the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, for the audio track of Toby Kears' presentation. Learn more about Toby Kears' research, mycorrhizal fungi, and the underground networks they form at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Is Bird Note. Late spring and early summer are the peak of birdsong. And how do you go about learning to recognize the bird voices you hear? Well, Roger Torrey Peterson, the best-known American figure of 20th century birdwatching, offered this help. In his field guides, he often provided a catchphrase to identify a bird's song. For example, in the song of the common yellowthroat, he heard witchetty, witchetty, witchetty. What better way to capture the galloping cadence and crisp quality of his song? A male California quail song can be remembered as Chicago, Chicago, Chicago. The olive-sided flycatcher's distinctive whistled three-note song has been likened to quick three beers. How about this one? This catchy song is often described as "See me, pretty, pretty me." If you hear this, you'll know a handsome white-crowned sparrow is nearby. In the east, you're more likely to hear the sweet, wavering song of the white-throated sparrow. It seems to say, "Oh, sweet Canada, Canada." Listen to all these songs again and find resources to help you bird by ear on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann. This is Bird Note. On a fine May morning in Great Smoky Mountains National Park, a song issues from within a rhododendron thicket. But try as you may, you can't see the singer. It sounds like a warbler. Many breed in this lush mountain habitat. Black-throated blue warblers, for example. American redstarts. And hooded warblers. But no, it's a Swainson's warbler, one of North America's shyest birds. Small and brown, these birds forage quietly on the ground, flipping over leaves to expose and capture insects. They scurry away, calling an alarm when big-footed humans invade their shadowy habitat. They're amazingly good at disappearing in rapid flight through the tangled understory. On their wintering grounds, in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica, they're even harder to find because they don't sing in winter. There, instead, you might hear a rufous-throated solitaire singing in the dense mountain forest. Swainson's warblers do, however, respond aggressively to a recording of their own song. That's how ornithologists confirmed the presence of these elusive warblers and discovered a vital connection between the two mountain forests 1,000 miles apart. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Thank you.